Welcome to Think on This.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to Think on This, Episode 7, Mobsters, History on Some of the Most Infamous Gangsters. If you're new to the show, this is the show where we pick a random topic that is of interest to us and break it down to get you thinking. Today we'll be discussing John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde. This will be a two-part series on mobsters. Next episode we'll be discussing Al Capone and Bugsy Siegel. We've heard all the names, but what are their stories? Let's learn who these people were and how they came to be. I'm John Montgomery from ThinkOnThisCast.com, and as always, I'd like to welcome our co-host, Austin Bradford. What's up, Austin?
Hey, John. How is it going?
It is going well.
Good.
There's some cool facts that we came across with this episode.
Yeah, we've got some pretty heavy subject matter this week, and I'm excited to dive into it. I really don't have anything cute to say. I'm just ready to get into the topic.
All right, then. Let's do it. First, I figured we'd give a little bit of a definition of a mobster, because there are actually differences between mobster and gangster.
Yeah, so as opposed to just an individual criminal, members of crime syndicates and gangs belong to a larger structuralized criminal organization. So it's someone who belongs to such a group as a mobster or a gangster. The term mobster comes from mob, which is another name for mafia, which is an Italian organized crime group. But the word mob originally just meant a large group of people or the common people. And it actually comes from the Latin phrase mobile vulgus, which means fickle common people.
Yeah. Now, the difference between gangsters and mobsters, the word gangster refers to any people who make a living from or make money from a crime in an organized manner by being part of a gang or a group of criminals. So, you know, with a mobster, it's more of a large structured criminal organization. A gangster can be any group.
So there you go. If you always wondered what word to use when, that's when you use it.
There you go. The word mobster was first known to be used in 1917 in print. Now, they may have used it in language before that, but just an interesting fact.
Yeah, and just to back up a little bit, I thought it was interesting that there's always a Latin origin for everything, but that the Latin origin just meant fickle common people. But yeah. That word ended up being used for a group of people who probably saw themselves above the fickle common people.
I would say so. Most of them were super rich and dangerous.
Yeah, but by using mobster as their tagline, they were just referring to themselves as common people.
Yeah, the time period for the mobsters, during the Great Depression, people turned to unethical and illegal ways of attaining money for survival. Then greed and fame fueled their efforts after the Great Depression. So that was just kind of the motivation behind a lot of these groups.
Yeah, and a lot of the Great Depression was a big factor involved. A lot of people were desperate. They were looking for any way to make money to provide for their family, so they got involved in some illegal activity. And this was also when alcohol was outlawed with the Prohibition, so you saw a huge influx of illegal alcohol sales, which led to a lot of money for these mobsters.
Yeah, a lot of bootlegging. Mm. So let's get into our first guy here. We got John Dillinger. Now, this is kind of cool because I'm actually from Indiana, Austin's from Indiana, and this guy was born like 2.5-3 hours from where we are from. So
yeah, one of the best things to come out of Indiana was a murdering bank robber.
Yeah, this guy, he did a lot more than what I thought when I originally started researching this topic. There's some pretty cool stories here.
Yeah, he's a pretty interesting character. I know that they recently did a movie with Johnny Depp about John Dillinger. What was it called? Public Enemy, I think it was called.
uh Maybe. I don't know. I don't know if I've heard of that.
Yeah, it was from what I haven't seen it, but from what I heard, it was a pretty good movie. I think it's called Public Enemy.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, definitely check it out. I'm going to check it out.
You're going to check it out?
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard it's a good movie. Okay. So.
Gotcha.
I was hoping that you had seen it so that we could talk about it, but no, it turns out you hadn't. No, so.
Unfortunately not.
shot that down.
Anyway, John Herbert Dillinger, was born on June 22nd in 1903 in Indianapolis, Indiana. He started out with just some petty theft, and while serving some time in jail, the other inmates around him taught him how to plan and organize his robberies. So after he escaped from jail, he formed a gang and went to Chicago to carry out some of these robberies, and he learned quite a bit from these inmates.
So he was a student of the craft. So he spent his time locked up to learn how to rob banks.
It's kind of like a Padawan Jedi thing, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you've decided that you want your life to be all about robbing banks, I suppose that a jail is probably the best source of information on how to do that. Maybe not, though. Maybe you shouldn't be taking advice from the people that are in jail.
Yeah, they got caught.
That also seems kind of backwards.
I guess it'd be more of a Sith thing. It wouldn't be a light side tactic, would it?
Oh, yeah.
You're going label.
It'd be more like a Sith master. But anyway, he was actually nicknamed Jackrabbit for his quick getaways and his graceful execution of these robberies and his ability to rob these places and get away so easily actually got him labeled by the FBI as America's first public enemy number one, and they placed a $10,000 reward on his head. They actually did it on his birthday too, which is kind of like a big FU to him. Just on his birthday, they're going to put a $10,000 reward on you for dead or alive.
And keep in mind, this is in like the 1920s where $10,000 is a lot of money.
Yeah, that would pretty much set you for life, especially during the Great Depression.
Yeah, so it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
John Dillinger robbed his last bank on June 30th of 1934. That was the Merchant National Bank in South Bend, Indiana. In that robbery, they got away with around $30,000 from that heist.
That's a lot of money, like we said. Do you have any idea what that would be like with inflation numbers?
Well, it would be. Let me see. I got a quick reference here I could use. Let me find it. Well, about $500,000 is about 2 million in that time. So, I mean, you'd have to extrapolate that a little bit.
We'll just call it like, $100,000 ish.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
So that's a lot of money for one heist.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was actually, what led to his downfall, he was betrayed by a friend named Anna Sage. She had been getting into some trouble with the INS, and she was facing deportation. So Agent Purvis, who was leading the investigation on John Dillinger, was able to arrange a deal with her where she would help bring in John Dillinger in exchange for American citizenship.
That's so sketchy.
Yeah. I mean,
I understand where she's coming from, but
I totally understand where she's coming from, and it's probably hard to surround yourself with trustworthy people in a life of crime. Typically, they don't talk to the police. That's kind of like the underlying rule. But still, like, if I'm working with someone to rob some banks, I'm not going to be too surprised when if they flip on me so that they don't get deported out of the country.
Yeah. But, yeah, what can you do? I mean, that would be the worst part about it. You can't have like actual friends, you know, everybody that you know is you can't trust them.
No, but I guess that's what you're exchanging for the $2 million that you bring home.
Yeah, I don't know if it'd be worth it to me, but
not for me either, especially not for $2 million. That's not that much.
Yeah,
I think a lot of it is just, especially with John Dillinger, and probably it's the case for most of the mobsters that we're going to talk about, is just the notoriety and the fame that they got from it.
Yeah. You know what? I got to make a correction. I said that wrong. $500,000 was equivalent to about $7
million. Oh.
I said that. I was way off on that. So just wanted to correct that.
That's still not enough. I would need more than $7 million just to outcast to everybody.
But anyway, fearing much of the Chicago police force had been compromised, Purvis assembled a team of FBI agents and police from the other areas to take out Dillinger. They, at the time, they were afraid that Dillinger had got to a lot of the police in Chicago, you know, and paid them off and everything, so they couldn't trust him. So they had Anna Sage. She was their informant, and they assembled this team on the night that they were going to try to bust him. She informed the FBI that they were going to go to see a movie at the Biograph Theater. This was in July 22nd of 1934. This was on a Sunday at 5 p.m. They went to this movie, and when they came out, Purvis was waiting for them by the door. Now, the cool thing is Dillinger actually looked Purvis directly in the eyes when he passed, but he didn't show any signs of suspicion or recognition. He just passed him up, and then Purvis gave a signal by lighting a cigar and pulled his gun on him, yelling, "Stick him up, Johnny. We have you surrounded." That's such a, like, classic film quote, isn't it?
That's straight out of a movie. I wish he would have said something cooler when he's about to take down John Dillinger. He said, "Stick him up, Johnny. We have you surrounded."
But it's such a cool line.
Is it a cool line?
It is. It's so like old.
Yeah, I mean, it is the 30s, but
that's exactly what I picture them saying.
Yeah, I picture them saying it like a high pitched voice too, like, "Stick him up, Johnny. We have you surrounded."
I don't picture that, but now when he said that, Dillinger tried to draw his gun from his pocket while attempting to run, but he didn't make it very far. He made it to an alley, and by that time he was done. I mean, he just got pelted with a billion shots. The bullet actually went through at the base of his neck and hit the second vertebrae and then exited below his right eye.
That'll kill you.
Yeah.
That'll kill you most of the time.
I would say so.
Good That's Lord.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah.
But they buried John Dillinger at Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis on July 25th, 1934.
So that was the life and times of John Dillinger. Didn't end pretty, did it?
No, it did not.
Well, we actually have, on top of that, we're going to go over some interesting or little-known facts about John Dillinger. The first of which being Dillinger actually served in the Navy. He stole a car when he was 20, and after a confrontation with the police, he enlisted in the Navy to avoid being arrested. But, as you can imagine, somebody that enjoys committing crimes as much as he did, he hated being in the military, and he hated being told what to do by authority. So he was often placed in solitary confinement for disobeying direct orders, and eventually, in December of 1923, he completely deserted the Navy and went AWOL.
Yeah. Another cool fact, he spent most of his adult life in prison. Dillinger was sent to prison in 1924, serving 8.5 years due to a botched robbery on a grocery. It's an Elder grocery. He went in and it failed. While serving his time, he learned everything he could from the other inmates on the tricks of the trade, like I mentioned before. And in May of 1933, Dillinger won parole and then a few days later met up with a gang in Indianapolis and started robbing restaurants and grocery stores. Only a few weeks beyond that, they moved to banks.
Yeah. So that was just back to what we talked about, how he learned how to rob banks effectively in prison, which is interesting. And I don't think that's a good strategy, but I guess it worked for him. I don't want to take my advice from people that have been caught.
Well, you could take advice about the things that he succeeded in. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I'm sure they completed a lot of things before they were caught.
Maybe. But ultimately, it was all ineffective because they're sitting in prison telling them how to rob banks.
Yeah.
But
I don't know.
Next one, Dillinger actually busted out his fellow gang members from jail. He wanted to form a very high profile bank robbing gang from these people that he met in jail and learned all these tricks from. So in September of 1933, he actually hid three 38 caliber pistols in a crate of thread that was being shipped into the jail's shirt making factory. Ten convicts, including a man named Handsome Harry Pierpont, Charles Mackley, John Hamilton, not the historic John Hamilton, a different John Hamilton, and others were experienced, and other experienced robbers were able to escape with these pistols that were smuggled in. A few days before their escape, Dillinger had actually been arrested. And then Pierpont and two other men walked through the front doors of a police station and gunned down the sheriff and busted Dillinger out.
See, that's pretty cool.
That
too.
Is the ultimate, like, it happened to be, like, it was just outlaw move.
Yeah, it was perfect timing. Like, they he busted them out, and then right before they got out, he got arrested, and they came in and busted him out of the other jail. It was a little bit more violent. I mean,
yeah, just walked. It must have been a lot easier to just get out of to just escape from jail.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, because you'll notice a pattern with all of these people, that these people are like constantly breaking out of jail like it's nothing.
Like, but you just put some pistols in a crate, and then like the inmates just got the crate and then broke out of jail.
It's like sticking a file in a cake.
You think they'd have, like, more than like a few guards with guns to stop them from breaking out?
You would think, but I don't know. I mean, it just, it's like all, every one of these people, it seems like they just kind of,
and then they went to jail out. And then they broke out of jail.
Yeah. I mean, we've got all kinds of funny facts about jail, about using a wooden gun to escape and all this stuff.
That's great.
But anyway, Dillinger, he actually built his arsenal by robbing police stations. You know that?
I did not.
In October of 1933, just after they busted out of jail, Dillinger and his gang just walked in the front doors of two different police stations in Auburn and Peru, Indiana, and they just took all their weapons. They just cleaned out their gun cabinets. They stole items like Thompson machine guns, shotguns, rifles, tear gas guns, bulletproof vests.
Was everyone just at lunch? Lunch? Like,
they just walked in, and no, they were sitting watching them take it out. Like, they just held them up and cleaned out their gun cabinets and left.
Man,
I guess if you think about it,
in small towns in Indiana, so maybe the police force is like no more than three people.
Yeah, maybe it's like an Andy Griffith episode where one of them isn't even allowed to carry bullets. And
yeah, an Andy Griffith episode that they have an arsenal in the back of the jail.
Yeah, they had a lot of weapons, but apparently they didn't have enough people to take care of it. I mean, it just says, like, it says their gang walked in. I don't know how many people were in this gang.
I'm sure
it was
a good amount of people. What's funny is these are actually these small towns in Indiana. Being from Indiana, you see these towns when you're passing by on an interstate. Like, you have no reason to actually go to them. But no offense to anyone that might live there, we don't usually drive through them. But I wonder if, like, their police station in Auburn or Peru, like, have a little plaque that say, John Dillinger stole all of our weapons.
I don't know, but I would totally
put one in there. Even if it's, like, what else?
Even if it's a terrible, even if it's a terrible name, you know?
Yeah.
But
I got something else for you. Dillinger, believe it or not, was actually a nationwide celebrity. He became as famous as a Hollywood actor can become, and in Indianapolis, there was actually a lottery in place that people were buying lottery tickets on when he would be captured, and it became so large that they actually had to shut down the lottery.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. Like, I wonder how big that would be. Like, it got big enough to where they wouldn't have been able to pay it. So,
it's too much money.
A lot of money. And it's a weird thing to, like, buy a lottery ticket on.
Yeah.
Dillinger's father was actually offered a bunch of speaking engagements because people wanted to hear what it was like to be John Dillinger's father. And when when Dillinger was arrested in Tucson, people filed through the jail just to get a good look at him. So people were just coming into the jail just to see him. And businesses actually started using him in their advertising campaigns. For example,
I thought this was funny.
A 1934 Hudson ad said, Dillinger chooses the 1934 Hudson for his personal use. And the response, will they ever catch John Dillinger? Not until they get him out of a Ford V8.
Yeah, later on he switched to a Ford, so Ford took control of that and put it out on him. Obviously, Dillinger wasn't behind those ads, but they still used him as material.
Yeah. So he was super famous and super popular, and I think we have one more fact later on that reiterates that, but he was definitely a national figure that people were engaged in what he was doing.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned escaping from jail using a wooden gun. When he was in Tucson, we mentioned that a second ago, when he was in the jail there, they extradited him from Tucson to the quote-unquote escape-proof jail in Crown Point to await trial. Funny thing is Dillinger was only there for about a month before he escaped.
I was going to say, I wonder how this story ends.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Titanic. They're like, it's unsinkable. You know, all these people bragged about how escape-proof this jail was, and he escaped within a month. But he actually used a wooden gun that he claimed was made from a block of wood, a razor handle, and some black shoe polish to fool the guards into thinking that it was real. And so he held him up, and then he went to their arsenal, their weapons area, and got a Thompson machine gun. He liked them Tommy guns. You notice that?
Yeah, those were very popular.
Yeah, it seemed like all the mobsters liked this. They're cool looking, I guess. But then from there, he made his way to the prison garage, and he stole the sheriff's personal car.
Jeez.
And drove off to Chicago. And then 3 days later, he teamed up with Babyface Nelson, and they robbed a bank in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
That's a good name, Babyface Nelson.
Yeah, we should have covered him. We don't actually have him in our outlines, but I completely didn't think about putting him on the list.
That's okay. He's definitely not as famous as the people we're covering.
Oh, he's pretty popular.
I didn't know who he was before we started this.
Really?
Mm.
Yeah, he's pretty popular, dude. But
Dillinger actually underwent facial reconstructive surgery to hide his identity. This is the 1930s, and he did this to hide his identity. By May of 1934, Dillinger was so recognizable that he decided to go through facial reconstructive surgery. He hired, and this sounds sketchy as hell, but he hired two underground plastic surgeons named Wilhelm Loesser, I don't know how to say that last name, and Harold Bernard Cassidy, and he paid them $5,000 to jack up his face. they removed scars, moles, they hid his cleft chin, they burnt off his fingerprints, and the procedure was apparently excruciating for Dillinger, and when he was finished, he wasn't satisfied with it. That seems like the case a lot with plastic surgery. He looked in the mirror, and he exclaimed, quote, "Hell, I don't look any different than I did."
Can you imagine all this pain where they literally break your face apart?
$5,000 just to have these two guys do plastic surgery on you. You'd look the exact same.
It would suck so bad. Johnny down the street just cut my face up for $5,000. This fact's pretty interesting. I really like this one. The federal government actually spent more money trying to catch Dillinger than what he stole in the first place.
Sounds effective.
Now, he, like I said earlier, he stole $500,000. That's where I got that number from. And that's roughly $7 million in today's currency. The FBI spent $2 million in that time's currency to catch Dillinger.
That's insane, because they didn't even catch him. They killed him. It's not like they got to like lock him up or anything, and he probably would have escaped if they locked him up, but
yeah, that's the
issue. They just spent $2 million to kill this guy.
So that's what, $28 million in today's money to catch this guy?
Yep.
That And he only stole $7 million worth in today's money.
Well, I hope they I understand you have to catch the guy,
but
I guess that's a lot of money to spend on one manhunt.
Yeah. But that actually, they say, you know, it was such a big ordeal that the, at the time, it wasn't called the FBI. It was called something else. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, but they had to organize different groups so intricately that that's actually what formed the FBI is what they're saying, that they put all this together and the FBI was formed because of this massive manhunt for this guy.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. And our last fact, his body was viewed by thousands of spectators. People actually went to the crime scene where he was shot dead and got their handkerchiefs out, and they were dipping it in puddles of his blood so they could keep it for souvenirs, which is morbid as hell.
This is so morbid.
Blood-soaked handkerchiefs in their pocket that they were trying to sell or keep or whatever. 5,000 people appeared at the cemetery for his burial, even though it was supposed to be private. That's a lot of people for a burial.
For a private burial.
Yeah. Yeah, especially for a private burial. His casket was actually encased in cement to prevent grave robbers from messing with his corpse, and they had to replace his headstone multiple times due to people taking pieces of it as souvenirs.
Why would you want to bust a headstone up and take it? I mean, that's just dumb.
How are you going to prove that it was John Dillinger's headstone, too?
You see this rock?
It's just going to be a rock.
It was John Dillinger's rock.
Like, unless you get the entire name, like, it's worthless.
Yeah. You'd have to at least have, like, a John D. for somebody to be.
To be even interested. Then I can maybe believe you.
John D.
John D., the most ruthless bank robber in history.
I don't know. It's just stupid to me. I don't know why you would. I mean, I can understand taking some of the other stuff. Like the blood-soaked handkerchief, I bet that'd be worth so much money nowadays, honestly.
Yeah, it would be now. But I can't imagine a bank robber now, like in today's world, that, you know, got away with a handful of bank robberies being as famous as John Dillinger was. I don't think people would care or even really know about it.
I think they might know about it just because of social media, but I don't think you'd be able to grow to that stature in the first place. I think it would be really hard to pull off more than one bank robbery, honestly, without making some sort of mistake.
Yeah.
Because they have so much now that they can do to, you know, find these people between electronics and, you know, all of the high-end analytics software.
But let's say that they were able to do it in today's world, it should be more impressive. So you think that they'd be more famous or just as famous, but I don't see people caring as much in today's world, even with the added security of it.
I don't know, maybe.
Especially not enough to, like, want to get his blood on their handkerchief and stuff like that, and, like, want pieces of the headstone. And 5,000 people show up to the funeral.
I think back then they were, you know, more in, what's the word, entranced by somebody that can get away with this kind of stuff. I think nowadays people just get mad that this guy keeps knocking over all these places.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be as cool of a thing. I mean, I don't know. It's one of the, you know, it's a negative thing, but it would still be really interesting if somebody was able to pull off that kind of thing where they just went on a crime spree for 2-3 years and got away with all this stuff.
You guys let us know. If somebody in today's world was able to pull off, let's call it 10 bank heist. Like fairly
big
large
bank heist, yeah.
Bank heist. And would you care? Would you think that that was impressive? Would you think that was pathetic? Would you? Do you think it would be a national story when that person was eventually caught?
Yeah. Just hit us up on our website at www.thinkonthiscast.com/7. And at the bottom of the page, you can find a comment section that you can put some input in if you like.
Yep. You want to move on to B and C?
B and C.
Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah. Clyde Chester Barrow was born on March 24th, 1909 in, what is this, Tellico, Texas? Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah, Tellico.
I've never heard of that town. I apologize if somebody from Texas
listens to this
and gets mad. But
never been there.
Now, Clyde actually aspired to be a musician. He learned to play both the guitar and the saxophone.
The saxophone. That sounds saxophone. Scary. Sacrifice phone.
The saxophone. Yeah,
he wanted to be a musician, and then he found out that you have to be good at music to be a musician.
He actually wasn't bad. Apparently,
I never heard him play.
I used to listen to him all the time, but you know,
I listened to him before he was cool.
Apparently, he would play in like clubs and stuff.
He took to a life of crime early on under the influence of his brother. They started with petty theft, and then they went to Grand Theft Auto, and then they transitioned into armed robbery. And by the age of 20, in 1929, he was a fugitive from the law. And around this time is actually when he met Bonnie Elizabeth Parker in January of 1930. So that's our Bonnie to your Bonnie and Clyde. She was actually a waitress at the time. She was born on October 1st in 1910 in Rowena, Texas. And when she was 4 years old, her father actually passed away, and her mother decided to move them to Dallas. She was extremely smart and excelled in school, and she actually aspired to be an actress.
So you got the actress and the musician, and somewhere along the line it went wrong.
Match made in heaven.
Yeah, when Bonnie and Clyde met, they hit it off pretty well, and it was put to a halt when Clyde was in prison for several counts of auto theft. Clyde was overtaken by heartache, and his thoughts started to turn to escape. So on March 11th, 1930, Bonnie actually smuggled a gun into the prison for him, and he escaped with all his cellmates.
I've never heard that story before. If we need to break anyone out of prison, do we just have to smuggle a gun in? Is it that easy?
I'm still going with the file and a cake thing.
I think people have stopped doing the really simple stuff, like just smuggle a gun in, they'll escape. Maybe we should just try that again.
I somehow felt like that would be a mistake. I don't know. They got metal detectors and all that now.
We won't know till we try it.
I guess. But then a week later, actually, they escaped, and a week later they were recaptured, and Clyde was sentenced to 14 years of hard labor at Eastham State Farm, where he was sexually assaulted multiple times by another inmate. It was just a very violent and horrible situation.
Yeah, that's not what you're looking for. It was at this point that Clyde had an idea of how he would get out of this hard labor. He was tired of doing all this work. He came up with a brilliant idea. Can't believe no one else ever thought of this. He actually had an accident, in quotes, I'm doing air quotes, an accident where an axe cut off a part of his big toe.
And it cut off his big toe and cut off the part of his second toe.
Yeah, it cut off the big toe and then cut off part of the second toe.
Big toe's toast.
So he had to walk with a limp for the rest of his life. But hey, he didn't have to do hard labor anymore. Turns out, though, while this was going on, his mother had actually been talking to the judge a few days before this and had arranged for him to be let out on parole. So he was already about to get off on parole whenever he decided to cut off his toe so he wouldn't have to work anymore. So funny how life comes back around.
Yeah, the whole axe thing and the toe missing thing is all in vain.
So he was released from prison 2 weeks later in February of 1932.
Mr. Limpy.
Can you imagine, I'm in prison for 14 years, but, I've accepted that I'm going to be in prison, but I don't want to work, so I'm going to cut off my toe. And then you do it, and then pretty much immediately after, they come to your prison cell, and you're free to go.
That would suck so bad. Like, really?
You've been let out on parole. It has nothing to do with your toe. You were going to get out anyway.
Yeah, that's the part that would suck. You were going to get out either way.
I just would have told the guy toe that it's toe. Because he cut off his toe. Just give him that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you cut your toe off, so we're going to let you out. After that, Bonnie and Clyde reunited, and they started robbing banks and small businesses. In 1933, they were wanted on several counts of murder, including several law enforcement officials.
Ew.
Now, in January of 1934, Clyde was the mastermind of an Eastham jailbreak to free a former friend, Henry Methvin. I guess that's how you pronounce it, Methvin. Along with him and several others, they were able to escape, and they ended up killing a prison guard in the process. That became what they call the Barrow Gang.
Yeah, so they're just running around killing cops, essentially. That's what it seems to be the case. It seems like everybody's just getting killed because Methvin and Clyde. Actually, on April 1st in 1934, they killed two highway patrolmen in Grapevine, Texas. And then they also killed another Texas Ranger named Captain Frank Hammer.
No, they didn't kill him. He was the guy that was chasing him. He's the big dog in charge of catching him.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. That's a period, not a comma. I need to learn how to read punctuation. But anyway, yes, Frank Hammer was in pursuit. And Bonnie and Clyde took refuge at Methvin's family farm in Bienville Parish. But Methvin's father didn't like it too much, so he ended up making a deal with the law enforcement to turn them in so that his son would be granted amnesty from any crimes. And on May 23rd, 1934, Bonnie and Clyde saw Methvin's father broken down on the side of a road, so they stopped to help him. But it turned out that's a trap, and the police opened fire on them, and Bonnie and Clyde were killed.
See, that...
That seems kind of messed up. They didn't even try to arrest
them. I feel bad for them. Yeah, I feel bad for them. They stopped to try to help somebody on the side of the road, or help your friend's father, and then you just get lit up by a hailstorm of fire. I read it was somewhere around 150 shots they unloaded on them.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and say that's an excessive use of force.
A little bit.
But, yeah, I mean, I guess they killed a ton of cops, so I didn't really care about arresting them. But that's still no reason just to open fire on people.
Yeah, well, that Texas Ranger, Frank Hamer, he was the one that put this ambush in place. He was the one that talked to Methvin's father and organized this whole thing. So, the thing I want to know is, Methvin's father had to be close to him when they just unloaded on him, right? I mean, if they get out of their car to go help this dude, how did they not kill him too and all that fire?
I don't know. I mean, I assume that he had a chance to get to safety somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I never heard anything about them killing him. So,
yeah.
But it's just kind of weird to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, just like Dillinger... These people took locks of hair and, you know, other personal items off of Bonnie and Clyde when they were killed. And this is another thing that's kind of sad. I mean, I understand, I guess, that nobody really cared about these people, really, but they wished to be buried together. You know, they loved each other very much, but when they actually buried them, they buried them in separate cemeteries. You'd think they could at least give them the last thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You would think so. I mean, yeah, like you said, they didn't care at all about what they wanted, but they definitely should have been buried together if that's what they wanted. I think it's kind of sad. To me, it seemed like Bonnie was kind of drugged through most of this by Clyde.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know she was going along willingly, but Clyde was doing some really messed up stuff, and it seemed like Bonnie was just along for the ride.
Yeah. Well, she busted him out. She's the one that smuggled that gun, so.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, she didn't actually murder anybody.
No, most of the time she wasn't involved in any of this. And actually, we got another fact we'll talk about here in a little bit with them. But you know, Clyde actually kind of jacked up her legs too, which I'd have been kind of pissed about.
Clyde seemed like a real POS.
Yeah. But you want to get into some of the interesting facts on Bonnie and Clyde?
Yeah, I do.
We got some more.
Yeah, we'll start it off with Bonnie and Clyde did not spend that much time robbing banks. You know, despite what movies and stories will portray, they robbed less than 15 banks. And some of them were actually multiple instances of the same bank. So they robbed the same bank more than once. So that's a bold move.
Yeah, that's sad there.
And Bonnie would sometimes drive the getaway car, but often she wasn't even involved. So that goes back to that point. She was kind of drug along for a lot of this. And restaurants and individual people were their main targets, so they didn't focus on banks that much at all.
Yeah. Another fact we have is Bonnie actually didn't smoke cigars. Now, when I think of Bonnie and Clyde, I see all these, you know, these old pictures where one of the pictures is of Bonnie holding a shotgun to Clyde's chest, and he's kind of smiling with his hands up in the air. And then there's another picture where she and Clyde are, you know, sharing this like movie star style kiss. But the most popular picture that people think of is, you know, Bonnie's standing there with a pistol in one hand and she's got a cigar clenched in her teeth and she's got her foot propped up on this Ford. And that cigar actually was just part of the photo. She didn't actually smoke them.
Hmm. It's funny how, because of that, she would just be synonymous with smoking cigars.
Yeah.
But that's the way history works.
They just had a little photo shoot, and people just assumed.
This is a good one. Bonnie died a married woman, but she didn't die married to Clyde. So Bonnie actually got married to someone else at the age of 16, and he turned out to be, you know, pretty crappy human and would often disappear. I'm not going to say he was as crappy as Clyde. I think she ended up with the worst one, but... he would often disappear for long periods of time, and he was actually in prison at the time of Bonnie's death. And because she was a fugitive, it was really hard for her to get a divorce, so they just stayed married.
And she actually had his ring on her finger when she died. She's still wearing the ring.
That's weird. I don't know why she would still wear the ring.
I don't know.
Unless she just wanted people to think she was married to Clyde.
To Clyde, maybe, I would assume. And now Bonnie and Clyde both actually had trouble walking. I mentioned this a little bit before, but, you know, Clyde cut off his toes in an attempt to get out of prison. And he actually he couldn't even drive in shoes. He had to drive in socks because it screwed up everything. And, like, his balance was all off and everything. But he also drove like a maniac, and which, you know, that's kind of something you kind of picture, especially, you know, if he's driving, like, some of those old classic cars. You picture these guys driving like a maniac trying to get away from the police, mm-hmm. you know. And so he was driving one day with Bonnie, and they had a wreck, and the car's battery blew up all over Bonnie's legs and actually burnt the crap out of her legs. They took her to some random house and put baking soda and something else. I can't remember what else they put on her. It was some sort of salve. But they put baking soda and the salve on her and was able to stop the acid from, you know, they were able to neutralize it. But, you know, if they hadn't done that, she would have died, because obviously you can't take, you know, a known fugitive to the hospital. So
no. Yeah.
She could barely walk from then on. She had to, a lot of times Clyde would carry her around because of it.
So they were just two cripples just running from the law.
Yeah.
Bonnie and Clyde were actually super devoted to their families. You would think two outlaws on the run wouldn't have a lot of time to talk to their families, but they would actually make frequent trips back to visit their families, and that was often multiple times a month. How would they do that when cops would almost assuredly be expecting them to go back to their family's house? They would put a note in a Coke bottle. And then when they would drive past the family's yard, they would throw the Coke bottle into the yard, and it would let the family know when and where to meet them.
See, that's another cool story. That's a cool fact, too. Like, just chuck it out there, and it's like a secret code.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that they still wanted to spend time with their family, and their family also wanted to spend time with them, knowing what they were doing.
Yeah, the cool thing is like when, you know, when Bonnie and Clyde were having, a good week or month or whatever, they would actually send money to their family. And then when Bonnie and Clyde were having a hard time, their family would support them. They would send money back to them. So it was like their families actually really cared about them.
But, yeah.
I mean, what can you do? You know, if you're a fugitive and or your kid's a fugitive or whatever, and you obviously most of the time people won't turn their own kids in. You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a interesting question to pose. Like if your son grew up to be a fugitive, would you turn him in?
Yeah, that's a hard thing.
Like, it's an impossible question to answer if you're a parent. It might not be impossible. It might be a pretty simple answer, but it's a complicated one.
Yeah. Now, another interesting thing is Bonnie and Clyde actually were unwilling killers. They didn't like killing people. They would kill anybody that got in their way, so that's why you hear a lot about, you know, these different police officers and stuff getting shot and everything, but they didn't like killing them. So most of the time, they would just kidnap a random hostage or somebody that was important or whatever, and they'd make their getaway, and then they would just release these people down the road. And, you know, sometimes they would even give them money to get back home.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's an interesting fact, but at the same time, it's kind of like I call BS on it, because I don't care if you feel bad about killing someone, you still killed someone. Like, you didn't have to make that jump to killing someone, you know?
Right.
Let's say that I was on very hard times financially and I decided to make a very tough decision to rob a bank just to try to make ends meet, or steal something to try to make ends meet. I still have, and a cop tries to stop me, I still have that choice to say, I'm going to shoot at this cop, or I'm going to go to prison, and I'm going to go to prison instead of killing an innocent life over something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, obviously there's a moral decision, and I don't really care if you felt bad about it or not. Most people that kill people don't feel good about it.
I don't know. There's some weird people out there, though.
Most. I know there are exceptions, and we'll probably do an episode on them one day, but
yeah. But I mean, take it for what it's worth, at least. I thought it was interesting that they would give these people money to get back home, like these hostages.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I'm not trying to make them up to be a nice person, but just an interesting fact.
Yeah. Last fact about old Bonnie and Clyde is, you can imagine, they were very difficult to embalm, considering that they were lit up by a bunch of police officers. And second note, they actually knew their embalmer. So due to the massive amounts of bullet holes, it was tough to make them presentable for their funeral. Clyde had 17 bullet holes and Bonnie had 26 bullet holes.
I guess Bonnie was a little bit slower than Clyde.
Yeah, so you can imagine trying to keep embalming fluid in these bodies that have holes all throughout them. You'd have to try to plug every single hole.
Man, can you imagine being shot 17 times?
No, I can't.
Because obviously you're probably still alive while you're getting shot, at least most of these shots, unless it, you know, hit some sort of nerve or whatever and took you in one hit. But that would suck.
17 times. I would like to think, because they'd all be pretty much instant, I'd like to think that you would die almost instantly with 17 bullets, or at least pass out and then die.
Yeah. I guess. I don't know. I don't know. It would suck. But it would suck either way. Even one child would suck, I guess. But
why would you even try to, embalm them at that point? Why wouldn't you just, put them in a casket and
closed casket?
Never think about it again.
I was kind of wondering that myself. It's almost pointless, you know. If it comes to a point where you have to unload 17 and 26 bullets into these people, you probably don't care about them enough to be able to show them at a funeral, right? And is it?
I mean, I wouldn't think so.
I guess their families probably wanted to.
Yeah. I wonder if their families I wonder if like Bonnie's family liked Clyde, or if they thought that he was a piece of shit.
I don't know. See, that's the thing that made me wonder, because, you know, they wanted to be buried together and they weren't. So I wonder why, you know, their families, it almost had to not like them if their families didn't even push to have them buried together, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have liked them if I was Bonnie's family. I would have said, that dude, I can't stand that dude. And she is not being buried anywhere near him.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know. That's a pretty sad outcome to, it's a pretty sad end to a life from two young people that could have had a completely different course with different decisions.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to cut it off here for this episode, and we will cover, who did we say? We here said Al Capone and Bugsy Siegel in the second half of this episode. They've got some pretty cool stories too. Al Capone was pretty. We got quite a bit of information on him. So
Al Capone's going to be pretty lengthy. There's a lot to him. He's kind of synonymous with American mobsters. So there's going to be a lot there to talk about.
Yeah, you think of the whole like Scarface thing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of cool information on that. That's more of the classic, you know, Italian mobster story.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll give you a couple ways you can subscribe. You can visit our site at www.thinkonthiscast.com to find our episodes. And we actually we're in iTunes. You can go to www.thinkonthiscast.com/iTunes for a direct link, or you could just go into the app and search for Think on This. You can go, we're in Stitcher, and we are also in Google Play, and it's the same thing, www.thinkonthiscast.com/, and then either Stitcher or Google Play Music, and we'll show, those are direct links to our page. If you have it on your phone, it'll open up the app directly, even though you're in a browser when you type that. You can go ahead and comment on our website too. I mean, that, you know, if you have information that you want to know about Bonnie and Clyde or John Dillinger, we have a lot more information than what we actually covered in this episode. We just kind of, you know, wanted to make it somewhat short so that you didn't get bombarded with a bunch of information. I'm sure we have something that you may be interested in. So just, you know, if you have any questions about any of it or any thoughts on it, just hit us up. And Austin, you want to give them a few ways to contact us?
Yeah. Before that, I just want to make a request to everyone listening. If you could please, please, please go on to iTunes and give us a rating and review. Again, that is super important to a new podcast, getting those ratings and reviews. It really helps us move up the standings on the new and noteworthy section and get us a lot more listeners. So if you could please just take a couple minutes out of your day to do that for us. It doesn't have to be a 5-star review. We're looking for honest feedback so that we can improve. If you enjoy the show and you want to give us a 5-star review, of course, that is greatly appreciated, more than you can possibly imagine. So a couple ways to contact us. We can be reached on Facebook at www.facebook.com/thinkonthiscast. You can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle for the show is @thinkonthiscast. John's Twitter handle is @IamJohnMon, and my Twitter handle is @TheLostCauseKid. We also have a voicemail line that you can call and leave us a voicemail if you'd like. That number is 1-812-518-0628. You can leave us an email. Our email address is feedback@thinkonthiscast.com, and we also have a feedback form on our website. That link is thinkonthiscast.com/contact, and that form will be at the bottom of the page.
Still buggy.
Still buggy, always buggy. Probably won't fix it. Maybe we'll fix it.
One of these days.
If it's working.
It's there. Just keep scrolling down, and it'll pop up randomly eventually.
But yeah, we'll have part 2 next week, and we're going to dive into some really interesting stuff for that, so make sure you give that a listen.
Yep. Later, guys.
Later.